Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 18th of January, as we record. Blue Monday is behind us. It's all plain sailing for 2024 from now on. On that positive note, we've decided today is the day to discuss emerging markets, beaten up, dragged down, generally having a miserable time of it in recent years. Are things now looking up, or is this another false dawn? We are going to discuss that question through the prism of asset manager Ashmore, which put out a trading update the other day. And then we're going to pivot slightly to our cover feature this week, which looks at an emerging market, but a relatively rare success story in terms of market returns and economic performance, at least. That's India. Then we return to these shores to discuss another trading update from ready meal supplier Bakkavor. And we finish with a brief look at Ceres Power as well. Joining me to discuss all of this, all in the studio this week, are Mark Robinson.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Mark. Julian Hoffman here with us.
Yeah, for a change.
Indeed. Alex Hamer also here. Hi, Alex.
G'day.
So we'll begin with Ashmore and with you, Julian. The trading update. Emerging markets, as we've said, have had a terrible time recently. Last year wasn't really much better, but with the expectation or the hope of interest rate cuts coming in a number of countries, not least the US, things may be looking up.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dan. Ashmore's had an interesting quarter. The shares have performed quite well, actually. They're up about 25% over the past few months. And that's directly linked to the strength of the dollar. Ashmore is really one story, and that's always how in favour the dollar is. When the dollar goes up, that's emerging markets tend to go down. And when the dollar goes down, the emerging markets tend to go up. In particular, the trading update was quite interesting in that Ashmore's fixed income and equities are both growing at the same time. The market shows quite good investment returns in those respects, and that helped to offset actually what was actually another quarter of outflows, which tended to get lost a bit in their trading update. But the outflows were still minus 1.6 billion. But the reason why people were sanguine about that was because it represents a slowdown from what they'd seen throughout most of 2023. And it inevitably begs the question whether Ashmore, which is a kind of analog for the whole emerging market sector, could be emerging itself from a long winter. And what this says about the nature of the markets they operate in. And it's inevitably a Marmite share as well. I mean, people either like it or they don't like it, but you can't ignore it because it's such a large and significant player in that market space that whatever their performance is, you've got to take note of it, really.
Mm. Yeah, there is this lag, isn't there, in terms of its own underlying performance insofar as the share price has been bid up on the expectation that flows will improve for emerging markets, and these results suggest they're at least not as bad as they were. The question is whether they'll be able to deliver on that. Ashmore is a fixed income fund manager principally, so I suppose in some ways slightly different because it's not just focused on the fortunes of the emerging market equity index. That said, the fixed income asset class emerging market debt tends to track quite closely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's also such a vast part of the portfolio. So they have like 54 billion under management, but 44 billion of that is all in emerging market debt and fixed income securities. In a way, the performance of equities in that context doesn't matter as much to them. I mean, the popularity of the debt is really just down to the fact that it's now quite reasonably priced in comparison to the dollar, and people in those circumstances tend to broaden out their portfolios and then buy that kind of asset class. So it inevitably helps them. But I mean, I would say that the difference between what people expect and what actually Ashmore achieves is always a quarter lagging. So we won't really know how well the company itself is doing until we get through the second quarter of the year, or go through the first and second quarter of the year, and somewhere around June we'll have a better idea of whether they're going to be more profitable, whether that's a sign that the current rating of 21 times at the moment, but has been 30 times in the past, whether that current rating in relation to its historic rating is actually a value proposition, or as you say, it's just a result of the swings that you see in that market.
Yeah. I was looking this morning at EM debt and the outflows, even in the past 18 months, because despite the high yields on offer due to the low prices, they haven't really been attracting anyone for a while. And one analyst estimated across the entire market that $100 billion has gone out of the asset class just since the start of 2022, which is about 20% of the entire asset class. So an incredible outflow. And you know, clearly that raises the question of when it will reverse. That said, when we look at the catalyst this year, clearly those rate cut expectations, the hope of a weaker dollar are paramount. Do we need those for Ashmore to do well this year? Does Ashmore need those things?
It probably does. The other unknown factor is how China is going to end up at the end of the year. There are some signs that they're getting on top of a few of the structural crises that they've had over the past year, but so much of emerging market debt, particularly in, you know, everything that's clustered around East Asia, depends on what China is doing. So it is interest rates, but it's also the performance of that big economy that will determine it. And both of those questions are really pushed back until the later part of the second half now, I think, depending on what happens with the next inflation reports. But the recent ones haven't been particularly positive about precipitating interest rate cuts.
We have had a bit of a row back this week, haven't we?
Yeah, the only point I'd make about this as well, and I'm not quite sure that it's all that relevant at the moment, is that the proportion of US-denominated debt in Asia has been steadily falling. Capital markets over there are sort of providing a greater share. But I mean, in terms of how it influenced the share price and the performance of Ashmore, I don't imagine that's significant at this point, but it's worth keeping in mind as we go forward.
Yeah. Well, Ashmore does have a lot of local currency debt as well, and both US-denominated and local currency EM debt, we should say, is less focused on Asia than the equities. So despite, I'm sure China will have a big influence on the share price, and you know, we can come to India in a minute, but a lot of emerging market debt is still focused on Latin America, where, you know, the rate cut cycle there has already begun in Brazil and may begin in Mexico too. So there are some positives there as well.
Not in Argentina.
No, well, I mean, Argentina's a different story, as has always been the case.
We cry for Argentina on this podcast.
You've thrown me there, but you're right. The other thing to say with the dollar, I suppose, with Ashmore, is even though it is to some extent reliant on the weaker dollar, as you say, is that because of its reporting currency and its assets are in sterling and the dollar respectively, in some ways, a stronger dollar is actually helpful in terms of reporting, but that is overshadowed by the underlying effect on the asset class and things like that.
I think it probably balances out at the end of the day. They do get, as you say, the profits can be boosted by that dollar conversion, but because it weighs on their inflows, they don't earn the fees to match the increase they get from the interest rates, from the conversion rates. It's a barometer share. I just, you know, you can't really put it any other way, and it's difficult for investors to play it as anything else, really. I don't think you would put it as a core holding, or you would want it as a diversification play at this point, I think.
I suppose the question is, would it be a geared play on emerging markets? Perhaps so, given the way the share price moved.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you are backing that story this year, maybe that's a more interesting way, shall we say, than an emerging market tracker, but one for the bold. Let's come to the cover story this week, though, now, because that, as mentioned, is also on emerging markets, on India in particular, because India has done very well in recent years, as the occasional pocket of an emerging market complex has done. But India has really been the shining light in terms of market returns and investor interest. Alex, you've written the piece. Can you say a bit more about some of the things you look at there in terms of the prospects for the months ahead, and also the economic prospects as well as market prospects?
Yeah, India has been featured a lot in financial press recently. I think the combination of a strong economic growth, or consistent economic growth compared to other emerging markets, and good equity performance has turned a lot of heads in the past, in the past few months. And there's a few reasons for this. I think, not straying too far into politics, but I mean, with Modi in power now for almost a decade, and and huge reforms coming through, including things like the GST, a real push to get people into the financial system through the opening of bank accounts, has kind of turned into a real change to in society that's now fed through to the economy. And that means things like people pay more tax, so the government has more money and then spends that on infrastructure, which means Indian companies earn more money by building that infrastructure. So it's kind of this, a few people use the phrase virtuous cycle when talking about India over the last few years. And looking ahead, Modi's up for re-election and, you know, the shift to a slightly more, let's say, ethnically focused or you know...
Hindu nationalist.
The Hindu nationalist movement, in this phase. You know, and I don't really go into the politics of it in the piece, but the likelihood is that Modi comes back in as shown by regional elections in December. And for the investor class, they are pretty excited about this. And, you know, I think we've seen a few, we kind of go through cycles in the EM space where you have countries, you know, rising through big government spending and then maybe favourable currency movements and they get a rush of outside interest. This is a bit different. This is probably a more fundamental shift in the country and how it operates. And yeah, it was interesting to dive in. My request for a month long junket over there was rudely denied, but
was I that spoke for your to yoga some
interesting
camp?
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's the case as well, isn't it, that it's often been said that demographics are falling India's way as well, especially compared to China. And it's an increasing middle class, a sort of a younger, well-educated, technically focused economy as well.
Yes, so
you'll understand why they sort of is looked upon favourably now.
Yeah, and I think, through the investment lens, a lot of that equity growth we've seen is driven by that middle class spending. You know, you look at sales of Western luxury cars, you know, the focus of even huge conglomerates like Reliance on middle class spending, and even the performance of companies like Nestle India, which is listed over there, to see that growth.
It's also the biggest market for the novels of Jeffrey Archer. I read that.
I can't believe I left that out of the piece.
If only we'd known.
Yeah. Well, I think on the, you know, you mentioned Mark the technological expertise or the tech expertise over there, and one really interesting thing is, you know, obviously you have these huge numbers of engineering grads and you know this offshoring movement has developed these huge, I guess, numbers of really qualified people in the tech space. You actually have a lot more of a shift to not just, you know, developers and coders who are sitting in cheaper kind of data mashing centers. There's a lot more project and almost thought leadership, even within the tech giants that's based in India now as well, that speaks to what, you know, the higher level of tech development there.
It's interesting too, because although the economy, people tend to focus on the economy itself, the fact that that's expanding at an accelerated rate, India's environmental conditions have improved markedly as well. And that's partly due to more capital going out to the regions, but it's also linked, I believe, to the increased mechanisation in the agricultural sector, getting away from old sort of wasteful practices, particularly in relation to water management and areas like soil degradation as well.
Yeah, well, I think that's an interesting point, because it still is a huge, what is that, user. You know, the water use in the agricultural landscape is still massive compared to other farming nations. And obviously India is at a different scale to anywhere in Europe, or, you know, if you look at it more compared to Australia or the US in terms of farming, water use is something they really need to look at further. I mean, even though there have been improvements. And that's kind of the risks ahead are it gets hotter, water gets harder to find. That means food supplies get more difficult. And, you know, there are solutions to these things, but they're expensive, and that is the path they're on. So, I mean, this is years and decades ahead, and it's not just India facing these challenges, but it is kind of on the leading edge of those risks as well.
Yeah, in the piece you you talk about the three C's being the biggest risks, being climate change, corruption, and conglomerates as well. To varying degrees, there are issues with each of those, as there are in many countries. But maybe we'll save that for the piece. The thing I wanted to come back to is the contrast with China, because sometimes it is about perceptions as well. And obviously, as China's star is seen to dim, India is increasingly being referenced by companies as the prospect for the future as well. Some of the companies you cover.
Yeah, for sure. The thing that turned me towards India a few months ago was the BHP CEO, Mike Henry, really talking up the growth in their sales there. And it's only a couple of percentage points, and it's, you know, for BHP China, it just dominates their earnings statement. But India needs a lot more. It's more met coal as opposed to iron ore, because India mines their own iron ore. But, you know, with all this infrastructure that's being built out, they need raw materials. And I think a shift in growth, not perhaps in absolute terms for materials demand, but a shift in where the growth is coming from is definitely India. And I think, and Rio Tinto pointed this out last month as well, where it's India and the ASEAN group, which includes Southeast Asian countries, that are really going to drive growth for them in the coming years. And, you know, the reason people are turning to India is because China is an interesting point where, you know, the choice for the government now is keep pushing for that 6% or 5-6% GDP growth through massive stimulus, and whether, you know, it's not just Xi Jinping sitting in Beijing, you know, pushing a stimulus button. This is you know, it is also slightly decentralized, where you have regions and states pushing their own stimulus, but towards that GDP growth figure. But as that, you know, slows a little bit, and the government decides that it probably can't just throw billions and billions and billions into the real estate sector to drive that growth, then India provides potentially a more sustainable option. And it's because of those factors we were just talking about. And so I talked a bit with an equity specialist at Franklin Templeton about that growth looking ahead, and his point was that Modi will probably not keep spending as high as it has been, but what will change is that will be taken up a bit by private players. And I look a little bit, you know, you mentioned conglomerates, and I look a little bit at Adani and Reliance in the piece. And Reliance, for example, is going to provide will likely provide the majority of the renewable capacity that the government wants over the next few years. And this is tens of billions of dollars in investment that will come from them. And, you know, the government will feed into that, you know, potentially through power purchase agreements, or, you know, they'll still be involved, but there is that shift that will come along as well.
Let's talk about how to access this story, because buying the individual shares is not really an option for most people. So it is either a fund story, or there are obviously companies with exposure to India. Can we talk a bit about that? And also maybe about Peter Hargreaves, the Hargreaves Lansdown founder, who you spoke to for the piece, because he is a bigger investor in India as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, starting with Mr. Hargreaves, so he puts his India exposure as just behind the UK and US in terms of his significant holdings. And, you know, I said, you know, tell us about your investments in India. And he said, I have my money in a trust that I can't tell you about because they can't promote themselves. So that was unfortunately a dead end for IC readers. But, you know, I did ask the question for the, you know, for the great unwashed. There are public options.
And just for the non-billionaires among us.
Yeah. I don't know about, you know, everyone in this studio, but I don't think we have any billionaires on the mag. So there's trackers. So the cutely named Nifty 50 is one of the top indices, you know, similar to the FTSE 100, where you can track that with various options. I've listed the X trackers one in the piece. There are alternatives as well. iShares does a broader tracker, which is MSCI India ETF. And that will just, you know, if you like the overall story and kind of want an easier option, that might be something to look at. And I think just a note on valuations, they are high. And the argument that was made, you know, people I spoke to, was that valuations are high, but earnings growth has not really been recognized yet. So, you know, if basically earnings are up 30%, share prices are up 20%, and there's earnings growth that should continue. So that basically these high valuations are still low considering the conditions was what people said to me. And then outside the trackers, there's specialists. I think Ashoka is quite an interesting option, which we highlighted in our top 50 funds piece last year. And it's not just a few people sitting around pointing at stocks. There's a kind of analyst teams who pick out shares, and if they do well, they get paid more, which I quite like as a model. And they're based in India, so you do get some ex-London knowledge, which is always a good thing. Yeah, so I think, and there's a few more that I list as well. You know, you're probably, whichever way you go into India, you're probably going to own a few banks. You'll own Tata Consultancy, which everyone seems to love. And then the alternative for investing in India is to back UK listed companies that have exposure. And, you know, there's two I mentioned in the piece. Hunting, which does oil and gas suppliers, their exposure to India is pretty minor, to be honest. They just opened a factory there. And then if you want a bit more exposure, something like Unilever is pushing hard in India. Once again, it's a few percentage points of their sales, but they're pushing hard into it. There's something if you want to, you know, go small cap, there's something like Saeta, which makes electric motors, and they are trying to sell. They've set up a factory in India and they're selling into the scooter market there, which is pretty large as a market. But yeah, I mean, I haven't put any, you know, these are not big buy recommendations. These are just options available if you like the India story. And then the companies themselves will have their own little issues. And, you know, so I recommend, you know, looking into it yourself.
Well, as we say, that is our cover story this week. So if this has piqued your interest, do pick up a copy of the magazine or have a look online. Now, though, we're going back to the world of trading updates. Bakkavor, Mark, the now FTSE 250 listed ready meal supplier to supermarkets, has just put out a set of figures. There's also been a bit of a corporate activity there in the past few days as well. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, there was a change in terms of the private equity relationship there with Baupost. They offloaded a 20% stake in the company in favour of Long Range Capital. I mean, the interesting point there is that Long Range get a non-executive position on the board, and it goes to Robert Berlin, who's actually served on the board previously. So the advantage there, of course, is that he knows the business intimately. And so the press release itself didn't make clear exactly if there was going to be any change of focus there. That will probably become apparent in the months ahead. I guess the main point of the update is it shows that the various reforms that are undertaken in November 2022 are actually having some positive effects now. They ranged across the board. I mean, a lot of it was related to cost and trying to get down the leverage level, both of which have been successful. There's been an increase in Chinese volumes as well, which was part of it. And there was a push to get more sort of regional focus too. Overall revenues, I think, were up by about just over 5% over the year. Underlying profits are forecast to hit the upper end of expectations or perhaps even exceed them altogether. And the cost synergies have been positive too. So it was a broadly favourable update. I wish I had a little bit more information on what was happening in terms of private equity. But as I say, that will probably become a little bit more obvious as we go forward.
That is interesting because the holder, Baupost, who sold this 20% stake, I think they used to have 40% at the time of IPO a few years ago. I mean, it's not done great since IPO, but bringing in Mr. Berlin, who was there around that time or pre-IPO, I think, as well, it was on the board, is maybe a sign that going back to first principles, who knows? I mean, clearly that has sparked some share interest in the past few days. The company, as we say at the top, you know, it provides ready meals, pizzas, things like that. So fairly straightforward in terms of understanding what it does. It provides them to the big supermarkets. We discuss elsewhere this week, I think that, you know, that kind of in, you know, at-home dining has been pretty resilient, perhaps as people cut back on other things. But supermarkets as well have been making a decent fist to put it euphemistically, of the cost of living crisis as far as they're concerned. How do we see Bakervor feeding into that? You know, if cost inflation starts to fall, is that going to be a concern for them if the supermarkets put pressure on their suppliers? You know, what do we see their prospects as?
Well, they're already operating under sort of paper-thin margins, which is to be expected, really, because, the market that they're selling into there. And they didn't exactly warn, but they highlighted the fact that even though trading has been pretty resilient, there are signs that consumer sentiment in the UK has deteriorated. And I think we can all probably see that as well. And they said that because their US operations are still being rejigged, that may present some problems in the current trading year. So their expectations are that revenues will rise, but only modestly. So, the outlook isn't exactly brimful of confidence.
Mm. Equally, spitballing here, I suppose, but we have seen some problems with private label suppliers over the past couple of years because they've struggled to meet demand as people want to trade down to find something that's more affordable. But if you're an operation like Bakervor and you can do it at scale, then that gives you a chance to grow your market share in that area, doesn't it? So maybe that can offset it as well. Final question about the company. The valuation in the context of what we just said, is it up with events? How does it look?
It's at the time of the half-year report, it was trading at about a 7% discount to net assets, and one imagines that hasn't altered significantly. Its forward rating is in line with Premier Foods and Hilton Foods as well. So you would imagine that it seems like reasonably priced at this point too. But it's always worth looking at companies that are trading below net assets. And who knows, maybe that's piqued the interest of private equity.
I think with the balance sheet improvement, that change of ownership, and it's something to keep an eye on, isn't it? Certainly ahead of the March results, which might provide a bit more detail, some more flesh on those bones. But let's conclude today with a quick look at Ceres Power, because today, as I say, is the 18th of January, and there has been quite a big surge in the shares off the back of this tie-up announced this morning, Alex. Once again, that should be viewed in the context of the very, very bad run the shares have had since their peak in 2021. What can we say about this deal, and does it point the way to better times ahead, or are people getting ahead of themselves? What do you think?
The run for Ceres has been difficult, partly because they were so inflated 2 years ago. And I think any company that gets its market cap over £1 billion with revenue of £20 million is probably in for some kind of reckoning. I think if you go back and look at our reporting at the time, I might not have recognised that as brilliantly as I just put it. But this deal is it's important. So just for some context, this company it started off as a fuel cell developer. So you basically get electricity out of it, lots of whiz-bang technology in there. And then the company has also shifted to manufacturing hydrogen electrolyzers, in which you put in water and electricity and then you get hydrogen. And that hydrogen can then be used in other manufacturing, energy storage, whatever you like. And the company has a few ways of making money. It's licensing those technologies and then looking after the units once they're out in the world. And it's sat around that £20 million. It took revenue mark. It took a hit last year when it had to push some money into some sales into this year and fell a bit further. But all that being said, they've signed a big new deal with this large Taiwan company called Delta, which will sell Delta, so license the technology to Delta, and then they'll work together to build a manufacturing facility or add on capabilities for these fuel cells and electrolyzers at Delta's existing plant in Taiwan, one of their plants in Taiwan. And it's a huge deal for Ceres. It will help them rapidly get this technology into the world once production is fully started in 2026. It you know, gives them a bit of credibility. I think the impact today was that the shares went up over 40% initially. That gain has dropped a little bit to about 30% by now, later in the day. But it should add, I think, 20. So it basically doubles their revenue this year. Once again, this is the company's rated, it's about £500 million market cap, and that will take their revenue to about £40 million. So even a bullish take on it from an analyst who backs their shares to rebound quite strongly, calls it positive, but also only resulting in minor changes to forecasts. So it's a good deal, and there's potentially some more to come from Ceres in the next few months. They've got a few joint ventures running that could result in similar tie-ups, but it's been seen as a massive step by the market. I think once they've got that revenue booked, we might have a better idea. And I guess it might be clear from the way I'm talking about it, but this is still not a shift towards profits. Well, it's a shift in that direction, but they're not there yet.
There's still some way off. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about the contrast or the comparison with ITM Power? Because the two do get lumped in together. Does this show that Ceres is further down the line, perhaps, or is it?
I think they operate in the same spaces, but they do have different business models. Where ITM struggled because it was building its own manufacturing facilities, and that initial outlay, when things aren't going right, became a bit difficult for them to sustain. So they had to row back on their ambitions. But Ceres has a bit more of they're farming out production and that CapEx. What Delta is doing is bolting on capability to an existing factory, which is obviously much cheaper and a much more efficient use of cash. Obviously, it means that Ceres doesn't get to book all that. If this goes perfectly well and they build this facility and everyone wants their electrolyzers and fuel cells, it means they have to share some of that money, but they didn't kill themselves in getting this all up and running. So the models are a bit different, but I think this kind of thing, I don't know, it's tough because you still have these big valuations and very little money coming in, which is where they are. They do have similarities.
Yeah. On that note, we have unfortunately run out of time. So thank you very much, Alex. Thank you to you as well, Mark, and to you, Julian, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.